Part 4. Memes. The Amazon Mystery. Chapter 11. Ghost Cities of the Amazon. In my quest for the traces of a lost civilization of prehistoric antiquity, the Amazon rainforest, at first, seemed to have little to offer. Without that teasing, tantalizing Australasian DNA signal, I probably wouldn't have given it a second thought. But the signal was there. It was real. It was hugely anomalous. And it cried out for a deeper inquiry. Along with much of the rest of the Americas, the Amazon entered European consciousness in the 16th century, the century of conquest. It was not a primary target. Mexico and Peru were hit first, their armies conquered, their wealth pillaged. Then rumors began to circulate of exotic civilizations rich in gold, hidden in the jungles beyond the Andes Mountains. The greed of the Spaniards was aroused, and in February 1541, Francisco de Orellana and Gonzalo Pizarro, the latter the brother of Francisco Pizarro, the conqueror of Peru, struck east from the city of Quito in Ecuador on a journey into the unknown. Their mission was nothing less than to find the fabled El Dorado in the remote interior of South America and to loot the vast wealth they expected to find piled up there. In this they failed, but in the grander scheme of things they succeeded mightily, for their expedition left us with the earliest surviving eyewitness account of the Amazon, unfortunately not of the pre-Columbian Amazon, which would have been ideal, but of the Amazon so soon after contact that it remained, effectively, in its pre-Columbian state. As such, it has much to tell us about the lost prehistory of the Americas. At the head of a force of more than 200 Spanish soldiers, Orellana and Pizarro descended from the Andes, hacking their way through increasingly dense and difficult jungle and fighting multiple engagements with hostile tribes. They eventually reached the banks of the Coca River, a tributary of the Napo River that is in turn an important tributary of the great and majestic Amazon itself. The terrain made further overland travel almost impossible, and far from finding and reveling in the supposedly limitless riches of El Dorado, the conquistadors were now depleted by illness and weak with hunger. Their solution was to build a fair-sized boat, which they named the San Pedro. In it, on Pizarro's orders, Orellana then embarked with a force of 50 men to seek out and raid local villages for food. The agreement was that Orellana would return within 12 days with whatever supplies he could gather. Unfortunately, however, the Amazon River system hadn't been consulted when the plan was made, and the San Pedro was swept downstream at such a rate that very soon it was hundreds of miles away, and the prospect of a return against the powerful currents was most uninviting. Besides, even if Orellana's force had been able to row the rough and ready craft upstream again, there was no guarantee that they would ever find their way back to Pizarro through the maze of braided river channels in which one opening looked very much like the next. They decided, therefore, to press on, and in the process became the first Europeans ever to navigate the entire length of the Amazon River and to cross the full width of South America from west to east. This was barely 20 years after the Spanish brought smallpox to the New World, another first, and the great pandemics that were to depopulate the Americas had not yet penetrated deeply, if at all, into the remote fastness of the Amazon jungle. The pale horse of death would very soon follow, but Orellana's adventure took place at just about the last time that the cultures and civilizations that had thrived and prospered in the rainforest for thousands of years could ever be seen in something approaching their original form and context. For that reason, we are fortunate that Orellana and his murderous gang of mercenaries, often starving, often having to fight for their lives, were accompanied on this desperate voyage by Brother Gaspar de Carvajal, a literate and sensitive Dominican friar who kept a journal throughout. In it he describes himself as a man to whom God chose to give a part in such a strange and hitherto never experienced voyage of discovery, such as this one, which I shall relate from here on. The expeditionaries frequently faced extreme privations. On one occasion, for example, Carvajal reports that after many days without food, we were eating nothing but leather, belts, and soles of shoes, cooked with certain herbs, with the result that so great was our weakness that we could not remain standing, for some on all fours and others with staffs went into the woods to search for a few roots to eat, and some there were who ate certain herbs with which they were not familiar, and they were at the point of death because they were like madmen and did not possess sense. But as our Lord was pleased that we should continue our journey, no one died. Whether by divine intervention or by good luck or because of Orellana's effective leadership, none of his tough and resourceful men died of starvation on the voyage, and only a handful lost their lives due to infections, disease, and battle wounds. It was, all in all, a 7,000-kilometer journey, the whole of which, from departure from Quito in February 1541 to arrival at Marajo Island in the Amazon estuary on the Atlantic coast of Brazil in August 1542, took 18 months. More important by far than his descriptions of the risks and dangers of the adventure, the great historical significance of Carvajal's journey is the shockingly counterintuitive picture it paints of a vast and complex Amazon. Certainly there were regions of complete wilderness where the expeditionaries suffered badly. Hundreds of kilometers of deserted riverbanks with no people, no crops, and apparently no wildlife. But we discover as we read on that these empty quarters were interspersed with regions of astonishing, heavily populated abundance, where great cities, more than 20 kilometers from end to end, roughly the length of Manhattan, lined the riverbanks. Here Carvajal reports that enormous expanses were given over to productive agriculture, and there were signs everywhere of large, well-organized political and economic systems linked to centralized states that were capable of fielding disciplined armies, thousands strong. These last glimpses of the Amazon before the ruination of European contact hint at a glorious, sophisticated, and technologically advanced indigenous prehistory. Carvajal tells us of one stretch of the mighty river, 80 leagues, possibly more than 500 kilometers in length, ruled by a great overlord named Machiparo. Throughout his territories, a single language was spoken, and the towns and villages stood so close together that there was usually not more than a crossbow shot between them. A week later, the Spaniards came to a fortified village, and finding themselves short of food, they took it by storm, killing some of the inhabitants and forcing the remainder to flee into the jungle. They then remained, resting, regaling ourselves with good lodgings, eating all we wanted for 3 days in this village. There were many roads here that entered into the interior of the land, very fine highways. Orellana took these latter as an ominous sign. The locals they had driven out of their homes might easily return with reinforcements, and the expedition sailed on, enjoying the abundant and varied foods that they now found everywhere on their route downriver. The next major halt was at a village that was on a high bank, and as it appeared small to us, the captain ordered us to capture it, and also because it looked so nice that it seemed as if it might be the recreation spot of some overlord of the inland. The residents put up a tough fight, but were eventually expelled. And we were masters of the village, where we found very great quantities of food, of which we laid in a supply. In this village there was a villa, in which there was a great deal of porcelain ware of various makes, both jars and pitchers, very large, with a capacity of more than 25 arrobas, about 100 gallons, and other small pieces, such as plates and bowls and candelabra of this porcelain of the best that has ever been seen in the world, for that of Malaga is not its equal. Because this porcelain which we found is all glazed and embellished with all colors, and so bright are these colors that they astonish, and more than this, the drawings and paintings which they make on them are so accurately worked out that one wonders how, with only natural skill, they manufacture and decorate all these things, making them look just like Roman articles. And here the Indians told us that as much as there was made out of clay in this house, so much there was back in the country in gold and silver. From this village, as from others through which they passed, There went out many roads and fine highways to the inland country. Oriana had previously resisted the impulse to explore these enticing jungle thoroughfares, but now, wishing to find out where they led to, perhaps even to El Dorado itself, he took several companions with him and set out. Once again, however, discretion got the better of valor. He had not gone half a league when the roads became more like royal highways and wider, and when the captain had perceived this, he decided to turn back, because he saw that it was not prudent to go on any further. No doubt, Oriana's prudence was among the reasons that so many of his men survived the perilous 7,000-kilometer voyage from the Andes to the Atlantic. But it is a matter of profound regret that he did not explore those royal highways through the jungle. In consequence, today we may only imagine where and what they led to. Unpalatable truths. Although widely discussed at the time, Carvajal's journal, the first eyewitness account of the full length of the Amazon in a near pristine state, subsequently disappeared from public view for more than 300 years. It only resurfaced in the 19th century, following an exhaustive archival search by the Chilean scholar José Toribio Medina, who published it in 1895. Still, it seemed that forces were at work to sideline Carvajal's uniquely important contribution to our understanding of the ancient Amazon. No sooner was the journal in print, at any rate, than it began to be debunked by scholars. For example, there were strident objections to a claim made at one point in Carvajal's account that statuesque female archers, whom the friar unhesitatingly calls Amazons, after the warrior women of classical Greek myth, had participated in an attack on Oriana's expeditionaries. Carvajal also states that many of the other peoples they met on the journey were subjects of the Amazons, whose dominions were extensive and whose sumptuous capital city had five enormous temples at its heart. In these buildings they had many gold and silver idols in the form of women, and many vessels of gold and silver for the service of the sun. Such descriptions enjoyed wide currency and inflamed the public imagination in the years following the voyage. As a result, the great river system Oriana explored is not today named after him or some other Spanish adventurer, but called the Amazon instead. To the skeptics of a later age, however, the link to the classical world that Carvajal suggested and the notion of a lavish city in the depths of the jungle seemed ridiculous. Nor was this all. What really stuck in the skeptical craw were the accounts Carvajal gave of the inhabitants of the rainforest, of the general level of their civilization, of the refinement of their arts and crafts, and particularly of the extent of their settlements, not only the fabulous capital of the Amazons, but also other very large cities, including some that glistened in white. By the 1890s, the view had already set in among anthropologists and archaeologists that the Americas as a whole had only been peopled relatively recently, and it was strongly believed that one of the very last places to be settled in this generally very late migration scenario would have been the Amazon. As this view tightened its grip in subsequent decades, it began to seem obvious to all serious-minded researchers, so obvious as to be beyond question, that the Amazon could only have been inhabited for about 1,000 years. And then only by very small groups of hunter-gatherers, since the jungle was resource-poor. Indeed, in the same vein, even as late as the 1990s, the rainforest was still being depicted by environmentalists as a counterfeit paradise, whose lush vegetation hid nutrient-poor soils, incapable of supporting large populations and complex societies. The reason Carvajal's account was disbelieved for most of the 20th century by almost everyone who reviewed it is therefore plain to see. The picture he painted of the pre-contact state of the peoples and cultures of the Amazon flew in the face of a dominant and domineering scholarly theory. Predictably, therefore, the first reaction of most archaeologists was not to question the theory in the light of the rediscovery after long neglect of an on-the-spot eyewitness account. Instead, they chose to defend the theory and undermine Carvajal by accusing him of lying in order to glorify the achievements of the expedition. The friar gives us his word, no small matter for such a man, that he wrote only the truth throughout. But his accounts of cities, huge populations, advanced ceramics surpassing those of Malaga, and enormous, fertile agricultural lands along the course of the Amazon were too subversive to be accepted. Quite simply, if he was right about all this, then the modern experts were wrong, and that could not be tolerated. Indeed, the judgment that Carvajal was a fantasist and a liar, and that nothing he had said about the Amazon could be taken seriously, seemed about to be set in stone when the first shreds of the evidence that would ultimately exonerate him, proving that he had indeed told the truth throughout, began to emerge. Did Amazonian cities exist? Professor David Wilkinson of UCLA, an authority on long-term and large-scale phenomena in world politics, including empires and systems of independent states, has made a special study of the level of civilization in the Amazon prior to European contact. The key question for civilizationists is, were there Amazonian cities before European contact? Civilizations require cities, and cities are the defining feature of civilizations. And by cities, we mean fourth magnitude settlements. In other words, settlements with a population of not less than the order of 10 to the fourth, around 10,000. Did Amazonian cities exist? Judging from the earliest reports of Spanish and Portuguese expeditions, says Wilkinson, the answer would certainly have to be in the affirmative. He draws particular attention to one of the cities, mentioned earlier, that extended for more than 20 kilometers from end to end, and to another settlement that Carvajal describes as more than 2 leagues long. The exact length of a league, Wilkinson notes, was not a fully agreed upon or stabilized physical distance, but was probably not less than 2.5 English statute miles, nor more than 4. A settlement of close-packed housing covering 2 leagues would therefore have been between 5 miles, 8 kilometers, and 8 miles, 13 kilometers, in extent. Here Wilkinson refers us to a study by an international team of anthropologists and geologists who focused on what is known about this settlement and calculated that it would have housed perhaps 10,000 inhabitants. As Wilkinson notes, this therefore makes it by definition a fourth magnitude settlement, that is a city, and hence part of a civilization. It follows that the larger settlement, with an extent of more than 20 kilometers, would likely have had at least twice as many inhabitants, that is, 20,000 or more. It is instructive to compare these figures with those of civilized Europe in a similar time frame. Certainly London, with a population estimated at 60,000 in the 16th century, was larger than either of the two Amazonian cities we're considering here. But the difference was one of degree, not of kind. The British city of York, an established urban center since Roman times, had a population estimated at between 10,000 to 12,000 in the 16th century, very much on the same scale as the Amazonian cities, while in Spain, Toledo did not achieve a population of 13,000 until the mid-19th century. On Carvajal's account, therefore, not only did the Amazon have cities, but its cities were comparable in size to those of Europe at the same time. He also reports that the chieftain Machiparo ruled over many settlements and very large ones, which together contribute for fighting purposes 50,000 men of the age from 30 years up to 70, because the young men do not go to war. Aside from the interesting anthropological observation about the age at which men in 16th century Amazonian society went to war, this statement has important implications for our understanding of the population of the region. Machiparo's domain was just one among many through which the Orellana expedition passed. Yet if Carvajal reported correctly, it could muster an army 50,000 strong. This is a greater number than Denmark and Norway combined, or Sweden and Finland combined, or Brandenburg Prussia, or even the Tsardom of Russia could field in the same period. A view of the Amazon as an uncivilized and savage place, indeed as the very epitome of savagery, has been deeply ingrained in the European psyche for centuries. It is therefore not surprising that Carvajal was disbelieved when his journal finally surfaced in 1895. Also disbelieved were the reports of the two similar adventures that followed. The Ursua expedition, which took place 20 years after Orellana's voyage, and the Teixeira expedition of 1637-38. There was no official recorder for the Ursua expedition, but one of its officers, a certain Captain Altamirano, provides independent confirmation of Carvajal's observations when he speaks of settlements with populations of around 10,000 in the heart of the Amazon jungle, at the lower end of the urban scale, but again, as Professor David Wilkinson notes, city-sized. By the time of the Teixeira expedition, the region had been riven by smallpox epidemics that caused depopulation across wide areas, and had also begun to suffer other negative effects of European penetration and exploitation. Nonetheless, the expedition's Jesuit priest, Father Cristobal de Acuna, who, like Carvajal, kept a journal, could report that the river of Amazons waters more extensive regions, fertilizes more plains, supports more people, and augments by its flood a mightier ocean than the Ganges, Euphrates, or Nile. Like Carvajal and Altamirano before him, Acuna too was still able to speak of an infinity of Indians, and of inhabited areas hundreds of kilometers in extent, where the settlements were packed so close together that one is scarcely lost sight of when another comes in view. These testimonials, Wilkinson writes, would seem sufficient, with eyewitnesses reporting the size of settlements and the wealth of surplus food available to support dense populations and social complexity. There could be, and apparently there was indeed, pre-Columbian civilization in the Amazon basin. The problem, however, as Wilkinson immediately concedes, is that serious doubts later arose. The first element of doubt had to do with accounts of subsequent penetrations of Amazonia, after the Orellana, Ursua, and Teixeira expeditions. In this regard, the observations of Padre Samuel Fritz, a Jesuit preacher, are of particular significance. He lived among the Amaguas, through whose domains, along the banks of the Rio Napa, between the Coca and Aguarico, the Orellana expedition passed, and which Carvajal, though he does not refer to the Omagua by name, describes as densely populated. Not so, according to Padre Fritz. Between 1686 and 1715, he established 38 Jesuit missions among the Omagua, and noted on a map that the important settlements among which he had planted these missions had a combined total population of just 26,000 people, quite a different matter from the hundreds of thousands reported by Carvajal. Let us note in passing, for there is a hint here of what was really going on, that Fritz's main preoccupation, other than preaching, was to advise these small, weak village communities on how to retreat and regroup upriver to evade continual Portuguese slave raiding. Likewise, a little later, between 1743 and 1744, the French geographer Charles-Marie de la Condamine traveled through the region and reported no cities or armies in Amazonia, again in stark contrast to Orellana. For Condamine, the Amaguas were a people formerly powerful, while along the entire river system he found no warlike tribes, inimical to Europeans, all such having either submitted or withdrawn themselves to the interior. These reports, and many others like them as the 18th century merged into the 19th and the 19th into the 20th, did serious damage to the credibility of the earlier explorers, to such an extent that Smithsonian Institution archaeologist Betty Meggers was still insisting, before she passed away in 2012, that Carvajal had either misunderstood everything he saw, or more likely, that his entire account was riddled with fantasy and invention. The Long Shadow of Betty Meggers. Throughout her working life, Meggers was a passionate advocate of the view that no pre-Columbian Amazonian settlement could ever have supported even 1,000 people, let alone several thousands or even tens of thousands, as Carvajal had reported. It was likewise her opinion that the level of sophistication Carvajal had described, the armies, the food storage, the porcelain specialists, and so on, was in fact completely impossible, given the limitations of the Amazonian environment. Megger's Amazonia, Man and Culture in a Counterfeit Paradise, published in 1971, but expanding on work she had done and conclusions she had reached in the 1950s, has been described as possibly the most influential book ever written about the Amazon. And indeed, it was this book and the environmental limitation movement that it spawned, because many other archaeologists, anthropologists, and ecologists simply followed Megger's without question, that for a long while served as the sole acceptable reference frame through which the prehistory of the Amazon would be understood. As Professor Wilkinson puts it, the meticulously careful and systematic researches of 20th century cultural ecologist archaeologists like Megger's created a consensus that large-scale settlements and societies could never have existed in what the environmental limitationists saw as the wet desert of Amazonia. But as was the case with Vance Haines and the mistaken Clovis First doctrine that kept so many locked in illusion for so long, so it was with the ideas of Megger's and her followers. A dominant individual with a prestigious position can delay the progress of knowledge for decades, but ultimately cannot stop the build-up of contrary evidence and opinions that will lead to a new paradigm. Predictably, therefore, as Wilkinson goes on to note in his study of Amazonian civilization, towards the end of the 20th century, the archaeological pendulum began to swing back toward crediting the early explorers' accounts. Even Megger's, in Amazonia, Man and Culture in a Counterfeit Paradise, had passed on without comment a report dated approximately 1662 by Mauricio de Heriarte that the capital of the Tapajos at today's Santarem could field 60,000 warriors. Any such number of militia would, by comparative civilizational standards, have implied an urban population of 300,000 to 360,000. It is troubling in retrospect that Megger's knew of, yet did not consider the implications of Heriarte's report. But of course, had she done so, she would have been obliged to rethink her whole thesis. Within 20 years after the publication of Counterfeit Paradise, however, other scholars were actively doing the rethinking for her. Notable among them was Anna Curtinius Roosevelt, now professor of anthropology at the University of Illinois at Chicago. In 1993, she presented evidence that some pre-Columbian Amazonian settlements held many thousands of people, from several thousands to tens of thousands of individuals or more. And in 1999, she wrote, "In Amazonia, non-state societies appear to have organized large, dense populations, intensive subsistence adaptations, large systems of earthworks, production of elaborate artworks and architecture for considerable periods of time." Likewise, in 1994, anthropologist Neil Whitehead concluded of the prehistoric Amazon, "We are dealing with civilizations of considerable complexity, perhaps even proto-states." And in 2001, Michael Heckenberger, James Peterson, and Eduardo Neves, facing criticism from Megger's, strongly defended their own by then well-established position that there were past Amazonian societies significantly larger than anything reported in the past 100 to 200 years, that these societies included chiefdoms or kingdoms, and that lost civilizations were indeed present in some parts of the Amazon before European contact. What are we to make of all this to-ing and fro-ing? In summary, to address the contradictions in the sources and among the authorities, Wilkinson asks, if there were Amazonian cities, where did they go? And if there were Amazonian cities, how could they have subsisted? He gives two-word answers to these questions: recurrent catastrophes to the first, and exemplary agronomy to the second. Extinction and amnesia. We'll come to the exemplary agronomy in a later chapter, but let's deal with the recurrent catastrophes now. Prior to the Orellana expedition, smallpox may already have found its way to the Amazon overland from Mexico, where it had been introduced during the Spanish conquest a few decades earlier. If not, then the direct transmission of the disease to Peru in 1532-33 by Pizarro's conquistadors certainly brought it into the Andes Mountains in force, making it only a matter of time before it descended to the east side of the range and thoroughly infiltrated the rainforest. Quite possibly, although there is no proof, the Orellana expedition may itself have been the first principal vector that carried the scourge into the heart of the Amazon. But if so, it was certainly not the last, nor was smallpox the only old-world disease to which Europeans possessed significant immunity while Native Americans did not. Measles, influenza, and other viruses also took a ghastly toll. Wilkinson cites an important study by anthropologist Thomas P. Myers that documents more than 30 epidemics, smallpox, measles, and other outbreaks, some on a massive scale, in 16th to 18th century South America. Myers finds evidence of very substantial depopulation between the Orellana and Teixeira expeditions, and estimates that in many areas it ran as high as 99%. This, he further suggests, may have been the reason why the missionaries later transmitted the idea of a relatively uninhabited Amazon region. The people they found were the survivors of the diseases and epidemics. The implications of the virtual extinction of the Amazon's pre-Columbian population are immense. If so many died, then we can be sure that much else died with them. As Wilkinson succinctly phrases it, a small city of 10,000 that loses 99% of its inhabitants becomes a village of 100 that can do far less. Likewise, by extension, we can imagine what would have happened if that city were just a small part of a great and complex civilization of the Amazon, and if that entire civilization were deprived of 99% of its warriors, 99% of its farmers, 99% of its hunters and gatherers, 99% of its astronomers, 99% of its healers and shamans, 99% of its architects, 99% of its boat builders, and 99% of its wisdom keepers. Of course, across the scale of the whole Amazon basin, this would not have happened overnight. Likely, it would have extended over a century or two, a creeping cataclysm, rather than a single big hit. But the end result, whether it came slow or fast, would have been the same. Once left deserted, the great cities and monuments and other public works of any hypothetical Amazonian civilization would quickly have been encroached upon and soon completely hidden by the jungle, while at the same time, cultural memory banks would have been wiped almost clean, and vast resources of skills, knowledge, and potential would have been lost forever. Little wonder, then, that to this day, amnesia, confusion, contradictions, and mystery confound the search for the truth of the Amazon's deep past.